Hello, this is Melissa. It is Real History, and today is March the 7th, 2024. And I'm talking with Elmer, who is in Thailand. He's originally from Norway. And we have just spent 40 minutes trying to get our tech coordinated. This is the first time we've spoken, and I think it's a testament to our patience here. So I can barely hear him, but this is an incredible improvement over the feedback and the fact that neither one of us could hear each other for a while. So hello, Elmer.
Oh, hello, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. I want to say before we take off, I have mentioned this to the audience, that you made a video, I think back in 2009, called Awaken the Dream, about chemtrails and geoengineering.
Yeah, that's correct, Melissa. I made that over a year period, undercover, so to say.
Yes.
So, yes, I did, and I borrowed a lot of cameras from colleagues, and they were asking me, what do you need all those cameras for? And I just gave him some stupid story that, I'm just filming some atmospheric, things. And I had like five cameras standing in each direction, east, west, filming for hours, And, and I put that together in my computer and I sped it up, for a time-lapse effect. And so I was filming in Sweden and Denmark and Norway and different places. And yeah. Generally, it was my father that first got me onto it, but he died 3 months later. And of course, I heard Alan talk a lot about that geoengineering. So that led me on in 2007 to really go deep into the matter. So I searched up all patents and I looked at Edward Teller's work and I had a few friends back then that saw the same thing and others just fluffed it off as usual. And so, but I had a lot of difficulties making it, editing, and I had a lot of problems. I couldn't load it up to YouTube even in 2010, 2011. So already then it was trouble to just get it out. So I ended up making a lot of CD recordings, and covers, hundreds of them, and just handing them out to people, that was interested. So that's how we got it around. So, and I sent it to Alan too, but I know Alan was very busy. So Alan sent a very nice email and thanking me but I guess he was very, very busy and things were just piling up for him. So, and I was very surprised to see that it was up suddenly after all these years. So you fixed that, I guess. So.
Yeah. Well, it was, you did such a good job, but we were crazy busy. There were so many things that we wanted to do, but we never had time for. And it's not like I'm sitting here with a lot of time on my hands, but there were a few things that I really wanted to get up, and your documentary was one of them. So, that's like one thing. I've accomplished one or two or three things on a list of a lot.
Yeah, I know. It takes a long time, So I used long time to make this. I would say I was delayed a year just by technical difficulties, The computer crashing, I had to restart, and, and just editing. And I know it's a very long documentary, and if I made it today, I would, take out the Alex Jones parts and stuff like that. But, I didn't know at the time, who that guy was, if you get my drift, because I would, it was very long, but it went into the green agenda and everything, and I wanted to connect the dots,
Well, that's good. I've got it up as two parts, and I think it breaks it into a nice chunk. It is a long documentary, but I think it is one of the more comprehensive ones on the whole geoengineering agenda, because you did cover all the bases. So.
Yeah. More or less. Yeah. And the funny thing was that, you know, my father and me, we had a very, very close relationship the last 5 years of his life after my mother died in 2002. And, you know, he was very open-minded and he was already retired on his 15th year. And he used to be an airline pilot and a fighter pilot. And he just showed me some video one day. You know, this was in June of 2007, and said, you know, Elmer, I'm sitting here out on the porch and I'm filming up the sky, and I know a lot about meteorology and, you know, all the Latin names for types of clouds, and, you know, and he was like, you know, but I never seen anything this like this in my career as 40 year flying around in the world. And this must be some kind of military experimentation. And he had not read anything about chemtrails. His hunch was, this is something that the military are doing in military airspace.
Here's the thing,
that was just
Elmer.
Like off the cuff.
He had observed. He knew what things were supposed to look like.
And he filmed with his video camera.
Yeah.
And he said, look, Elmer, they're expanding and expanding and expanding these trails. This is not normal. This is not water condensation trails. And I should know I have 25,000 flying hours all over the world with Boeing 747s and you name it, you know. And I even went into his video archive. I found some footage, you know, of him filming normal contrails from a jet just above them. Coming into New York, you know, I've lost those tapes, unfortunately, and a lot of them moving from apartment to apartment. But never mind. But you know, he actually got me onto that one, and Alan Watt, of course, without Alan, I wouldn't have probably made any of this, you know. And it was like, you know, when you went into the U.S. patent office and you could find patent 3,204 Chang, Mr. Chang from Hughes Aircraft Company, 1992. And, you know, it was all there, and you had all these people from CFR that admitted they were going to do it. And then now they're admitting they are doing it. But that's many years later. But what I found out that people, I had some friends that were like roof makers, and they were noticing it because they were early up in the morning and they saw this thing coming in, and that was strange. And, you know, like you probably have experienced, people with the more academic education you have, the more brainwashed they are, right? So, but people with less, like a normal intelligence, this is not normal. Never saw this before, you know, and he was in my age now. I'm 55, but this was many years, it was 15 years ago. So, but he's, you know, that was, you know, astonishing. But when I tried to show it to my engineer friends, which actually one guy worked in the weapon industry in Norway, he was like, oh, they tried all kinds of excuses. Just because there's more pollution in the air, that's why they're hanging longer, and it's just contrails. Oh, okay. no, it's not, you know, and it got worse year by year. So the weather in Norway has been terrible, you know, from, I would say, 2007 up till today. It's raining a lot more than normal. It's always eggshell covered. And I know many people that know about this, but, you know, it's like, yeah. But it's still a no-go area in some ways, you know, even for, and it's like, but I think it's, like Alan said, it has like probably 10 layers to it, the reason they're doing it. So, and, you know, everything from conducting the sky, making that conductive to have impact on our biological bodies by, you know, releasing all those particles and metals, and that comes in the soil, in the food, into the air. I also mentioned, I knew that Alan was a smoker, well, smoked cigarettes, right?
Yeah, well, he did for a long time. He did eventually quit.
I'm still smoking, but he said something very interesting. He said that, you know, when you smoke, you get tar on your lungs, the capillaries on your lungs. And he had a theory that that actually protected the lungs a little bit. So
yes,
he coughed up a lot of
this crap. That was interesting. I mean, ultimately, the damage that he thought that it was doing to his health, you know, he had to give it up. But he did think, and I have talked to other smokers who have felt that, you know, just by their own experimentation of not smoking, you know, if they took a break and then smoking, they said that they felt more alert when they were smoking, that somehow that blocked the worst.
Yeah, and there's this, I studied nicotine, of course smoking, I don't recommend people smoke, but if you smoke natural tobacco with as least chemicals as possible, you still get, you know, the nicotine repairs brain cells. That's proven by many different scientific studies,
mm-hmm.
nicotine in itself. But also what I've discovered that people that are what we call awakened or can see more than others, most of them are smokers. You know, everywhere I met them, here in Thailand, Norway, England, wherever, they're smokers. That's just fascinating.
It is
so, but that could also be, you know, other social things that, you know, but still. But then that's a side step. So no, I made that, and it was a harrowing job to get all the pieces together, and you know, but mostly I had some. I was living on a small farm in Sweden mostly when I was editing this, sitting in front of the fireplace, and I had to use this kind of mobile, you know, modem, and if I needed some documents to download, it took forever. And I had, I don't know, I can't prove this, but you have to trust me on this one, but I had an apartment in Oslo, so when I had freelance film work, which, well, I'm a freelance film photographer, I went to Oslo for a few days and I did my job and, you know, went back to the little village, or the little farm in Sweden. But there, one day in about March, you know, and I was like, my father was very, very tenuous with me that I always checked, I double checked, I locked the door before I left my home and all that, you know. And I always double check. And I came back to the cabin and the door was locked, but, you know, the lock was open. And I said, that's strange. Never happened to me before.
Well, what do you mean the door was locked, but it was open?
Yeah, but the door was not standing open. It was not locked, you know?
Uh-huh.
And this was like in the middle of the Boondoggles, really like Alan Watt lived, you know, really in the movie,
right.
Boondoggles. A small little farm I bought for a very small price after my father died in 2007. And I was going to try to grow food there, you know, when the spring came and all that. But, you know, that didn't happen. But the point being is that when I came inside, I said, okay, well, there's the first thing for everything. Maybe I just lost. I was 2 weeks out since I've been at the farm, so maybe I just forgot to lock it with us. I never do that. And then I came into my apartment, not into the living room of the farm, and then I just got the lights on, you know, I got the fire going, and then I said, okay, I'm going to have myself a brandy or a cognac or something. It was a long drive, 3 hours from Oslo, and it was a weekend, and I had been working for a whole week, and I couldn't find, I had one crystal favorite glass that was my father's, and that was gone. I said, that's very strange. I always put that in the corner in the cupboard in the kitchen. So that was gone. Okay, I used another one, and it's just, that's strange. Got some ice cubes. And then I went into the living room and I put on some lights and then just strolled about. And then I noticed that some of the books in my bookshelves were just moved, you know?
Interesting.
Because the color of, yeah. And here comes the kicker when I said, that's very strange. And somebody's been in here and somebody's pulling my leg. That's what my instinct were. And come April, May, all the snow had thawed away into the forest. I was out with my dog, just walking about. And don't you think I find that glass standing on a stub, you know, like a cut down tree, where, you know, 200 meters behind my house.
So you never drink so much brandy that you would take that fine crystal of your father's and leave it.
It is out in knee deep in snow and just, I put my glass here, you know, and no, but it was like more or less half covered with snow still, but I just saw it and it glimmered and said, my God, there it is. And then it all came to me. Somebody's been there just, you know, poking me. You know, from certain authorities, I don't know, Swedish secret police, I don't know. But that was just during my time producing this documentary, mm-hmm. actually. Mm-hmm. So that was very strange. Another episode that happened, I think, the same year, but earlier, my farm was like, I had one neighbor, but he was like 80 years old. He was a hunter, and in the summertime, he had some vegetable agriculture going on, and very nice old school man. But, you know, there was no neighbors, you know, and there's no reason for nobody to come down there because it's like 4 kilometers from a main road, mm-hmm. from a small, nobody's village. And then when I was driving out 9 o'clock in the morning, I was going back to Oslo to do another job. There was this, like in Audi, Volkswagen, Audi station wagon. And it was, you know, all new. And he was just standing there, idling engine. I was just driving by in my Jeep. And there was a guy inside. And he was just eyeballing me all the time. And then I'm just like, what the hell are you doing here? Mm-hmm. There's nothing to see. You're just, it's a dead end, you know, road. Just another 100 meters, you know. So it was like small things like that. You know, I find that interesting.
What you're talking about, you know, Alan had similar things that happened to him and that also happened to me, you know, when I was there. But one thing that happened before I was up there was a similar thing. You know, there was no reason for anybody to be there because there were two houses on his side of the railroad tracks, and then there was one other house that was down in this kind of valley area in front of the railroad tracks, and those were the only three houses for like 2 kilometers. So even if somebody got completely turned around, you know, there was a turnout there, so they'd figure out, okay, I'm not where I want to be, I'll use the turnout and go back. But he had the person that would just sit there the way you're describing. And they did it almost like intimidation. So 4 or 5 days in a row, they just parked their car there. And they had those kind of shaded windows that, you know, the black cars have, you know, the official cars.
Yeah.
And finally, on the fourth or fifth.
Yeah, it had tinted windows.
Yeah, tinted windows. On the fourth or fifth day, he walked down to the car. And he was literally like 3 feet away from the window. And finally, after he just stood there for, you know, 15, 20 seconds, enough for it to be uncomfortable, they rolled down the window and they had the kind
Hello?
Of, they said,
yeah.
He said, hey, listen, you guys, if you're going to sit here and watch me, would you like a little coffee? And they're like, oh, no, you know, and they ended up leaving and not coming back. But it was an intimidation thing. And when they saw that it wasn't working, the other thing that happened, this actually happened when I was there, and it was a spooky thing. Alan had told me before I was there that he had found bugs, you know, wiretapping bugs. Yeah. And he showed me where in the house that they had been, where he had found them. So he was always kind of on the alert for someone coming in the house. Now, that was weird. What he described was something high level, because he came back and the door was locked and there was no sign anywhere. And he, he was talking to someone on the phone. And the next day, and he heard what he had said to that person was being repeated out of the mouth of a radio host, a piece of information.
That is interesting.
Yeah. And that, and that actually happened, even though we were always very conscious of it and looking for that kind of thing. Because keep in mind, and Alan was fond of pointing out, that they can use, they don't have to put a bug, because that's really old school.
No.
They can use all kinds of things, a jack or a different meter in your house, and get a recording off of that and get the information that they need. But we would, several times, something that we talked about or something that he talked about on the phone with somebody else, and that's two different technologies there. He's on the phone, or the other one was just the two of us talking, not on the phone. And I heard that we heard different hosts, not just one, but several different people over the years would repeat back things that, you know, and it would be almost in real time, so that a few hours later or the next day. And Alan's position on this was that more than anything else, it was about intimidation. One time we went grocery shopping and we came home from the grocery store and the door, it had been played with, but played with in a way that was almost like a deliberate message.
It should be that I've been there nibbling on, scratching a little bit. You know, right?
Yeah.
They do that. And I heard about some other, that's many years ago, but he was living in Sweden at the time and his bike was, you know, he came out of some shopping and then his bike was moved like 10 meters down and open and locked again at a different place. He was also a truth seeker. So they do these tactics for sure.
There's somebody else that else that talked to Alan one time, and I can't say who they were. I mean, I won't say who they are, but they described an intimidation. In other words, they were people who also spoke out and they had their own show. And they told Alan that various kinds of intimidation had been used, exactly what you're talking about. And these things sound really paranoid, like you've got delusions when you repeat them to someone. So Alan, he wouldn't really talk about it, but they described going into the bathroom, knowing that they had left their towels hanging in a certain way, but then coming back and the towels were different. They had been moved. And this happened to them over and over again. And they kind of got into a game with it where they would put something, all but have cameras in the house to see. And sure enough, they would come back. There would be no evidence of illegal entry, but things were moved and played with just to mess with your head. One thing that I wanted to get before we go further is just a little bit more of your background. We talked about the project that you did, but you're from Norway and you have also worked as a professional photographer. And now you're living in Thailand. So if there is anything that you want to fill in there, if you want to fill in gaps and talk about your background, that'd be great.
Yeah. I can tell you about after military, which in Norway everybody had to attend at the time, and that was 89-90. I was 1 year in the infantry, and then I started at film school 1991. Film and photo school, examined 2 years later, got a job at the school before I was finished, was an assistant to the film teacher. Then he stopped working at the school because he thought they were educating too many for the small country of Norway. And that was a good call. And then he had such a large network, and you know, he has been professional for 30 years. So I started working for him, because I was good at my work. And through him, I got contacts and I started traveling all over the world since 1996 as a freelance. Then I became a freelance, got my own television camera equipment, sound, lights, everything. And from 96 to 2018, I traveled the world.
Did you do mostly?
I've been to like 85 countries all over Africa, Latin America, Myanmar, Congo, and so many places you wouldn't believe.
So journalistic photography, journalism.
Yeah, making documentaries for and working with, you know, I had like at least 6 different clients that worked internationally, but was based in Oslo. So I worked for German television, Norwegian television, Japanese television, you know, all kinds, British, you know, so all kinds of topics, you know, it was everything from, you know, hunger, poverty, all these things, AIDS problems, you know, I was covering that war, conflict in Myanmar. I think I've been 25 times to Myanmar.
Oh, my goodness.
And one time, and I was embedded for 2 months there with the Karen guerrilla, all alone, just taking pictures for a book. That was my first book project, and that was pretty interesting. I got the malaria, the dengue fever, two times, dengue once. Yeah, so, but, you know, I liked it because, you know, that was just, you know, in 1999, Big Brother came on the television screens and I could either stand in a big hangar filming, you know, that trash TV, or I think, oh, I'd rather go and see the world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. So I went freelance, you know, completely in 96, and then I just like, I met the Norwegian-German journalist and he said that I need one guy I can depend on and call because it can be on short notice. And can you travel like 50 to 100 days a year? Yeah, sure. And then I got other contacts after a while because then I was traveling, you know, most of the year, you know. So I was, and we went a lot to the Central American region with him. But he was married to a Norwegian TV producer and had 3 children in Norway, so he was practically become a Norwegian. But, you know, he had German contacts in the television industry and so forth. So we had a lot of trips to Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Peru, Bolivia, these places, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we did different, you know, we worked with a lot of different Norwegian aid organizations, you know, and they sponsored the TV programs and then the TV channels, and we had some celebrity singers with us sometimes, and yeah, you know, all kinds. But we made a documentary about, for example, the peace deal that Norway was brokered in Guatemala in 1994. We made that in 1998 for the Foreign Department of Norway. So we made an hour documentary on that, and I made so much, you know, it's countless, so many programs and features, documentaries, it's, you know, and that was back in the videotape days, you know, so all the TV channels, they sit on that material now. And, but later, you know, in the digital world, I could, you know, take the memory cards from the cameras and, you know, dump it over to my computer. And so I had a lot of my own material from, you know, that was like many years later, but I wish I had more of the programs, you know, the documentary is still out, but that's what it is. It's, but I got to see the world, and to such an extent that when I came to certain villages in Guatemala, they recognized me year from year because I was there like a couple of times a year, you know, with different clients, you know. Oh, el fotografo a Norvegico, you know, and so it's funny. So... So it's, and I got to know a lot about, and then also another thing with my career that kind of, I stood out a little bit from the other freelancers is that One, I wasn't afraid of, you know, going to conflict zones. And two, I was always reading about the different countries I was visiting. And this, the journalist, the producer appreciated a lot because, you know, there's a lot of transport, you know, there's a lot of waiting, you know. Mm-hmm. You're sitting at the hotel lobby, you're sitting and having dinner, you're on an airplane, you're on the bus, in the jeep. But they can actually talk to me because I had read a lot. So I had, you know, read about the civil war in, for example, Guatemala, and I knew a lot about what happened there and CIA involvement and so forth. So they liked that they could discuss things with me. So I was just not just a photographer, you know. So,
right.
So I read a lot of, first I started with Noam Chomsky and then I went deeper and, you know, and then later, out in the early 2000s, I think the first time I heard Alan was in 2004 or 5. Yeah, very early.
Long time, yeah.
And, yeah, and then even I burnt CDs and gave them to my father also, and he loved listening to, oh, I love his voice, he's so calm. And my father was so, yeah, and he was like, and so much new things I learned. And he loved to hear about, you know, old history and, yeah. So, you know, when he passed away, that was very hard for me because he was not only my father, but we had a very great connection at the end there, the last 5 years of his life. And he was like, you know, he actually got me to see that 9/11 was an inside job because I gave him a book. And then I was off to Africa on some assignment. And then when I came back, he had read it 2 times. You got to read this book, Elmer, you gave me. And then it was something about the new Pearl Harbor, it was called, or something like that. And then I read it and like, oh my God. And you're right. And then we dwelled deep into the 9/11, you know, because he was a pilot and he had been to New York 300 times landing in, you know, since the 60s and taking off. And he just like from a pilot standpoint is did this story is just hogwash, you know?
Yeah.
and so on. So, but you know, sadly he passed away in 2007 in August. There's so much more I would like to talk to him about. And, but he died in just 6 days from acute leukemia.
Oh.
So that was, yeah. In 5.5 days, he died. He was just walking about and was fine. And then even the doctors were baffled because it was so short time frame. So,
did he didn't even really have symptoms. It was just there and then that was it.
It just came. He had pain in his left knee. Right knee, and then we took it into the ER, and they did some tests, and then the day after, he got acute leukemia. And then 2 days later, he went into a coma, and, the whole immune system shuts down, and your blood production shuts down, and everything got infected, and I lost contact with him, you know, that weekend, and I just played, you know, some records, some old jazz records on a small CD player for him and talked to him because I know they usually hear, you know?
Yes.
And
yes.
Made sure he got other painkillers. But even the doctors were baffled because he died so fast. The world record is 48 hours to die from acute leukemia. But it's very normal for pilots to, if they get cancer, to get leukemia.
Really?
Because they're flying very high. Yeah. And stewardesses and all air cabin personnel. Yeah. So the world record is 48 hours. My father died in maybe 78 hours or something like that.
So,
one of my Twitter friends, they said, it's probably foul play. They gave him cancer. So I don't know. We can't prove that. I said, you know. Yeah, but he was going to call, you know, he was very vocally called all pilots, you know, friends, colleagues, and talked about 9/11 a lot. And I said to my dad that, you know, they're probably going to think you're crazy. And, well, they did, you know, so many. So I don't know. There could be foul play, but I can't prove that. So, because he was just like up and going and so healthy and just so fast, you know. So,
sorry about that. That must have been very hard for everybody in the family and to lose your, you know, dad and your very good friend.
Yeah. Yeah, and he was so smart. He was like a part-time inventor on his free time. He was like, but he still had a very young mind, open mind. So he was open for all the things, and we discussed Knights Templars and everything. And it was the very good times, you know. So I missed that, but I got friends during, because I blogged for so many years. I blogged for almost 10 years. In Norwegian and English, two different blogs. And I got friends through the Norwegian blog, so we got to be a little group, about 7 and 8 people, and we came together every 2-3 times a month and, you know, exchange books and discuss different topics. You know, that was very nice to have people to talk to, mm-hmm. which, you know, were on the same level.
Yeah.
So we had kind of a club. Truth to club.
Well, that's good. You know, so many people come into this information and start to see that reality isn't as it's been presented, and they have no one to talk to, you know. That's tough.
I know. It's very, very tough to be in you feel like a stranger in a strange land, like mm-hmm. I say. After a while, because you actually discover that you've been lied to about almost everything, and then you get angry, and then, you know, and finally you accept it, you know, and then, but I've lost so many, you know, college friends, you know, I still have one left that 20 years later, he says to me that, like, you know, 19 years later or something like that, he says, you know, Elmer, I thought you were crazy, but a lot of the things you have discussed about geopolitics and such, it all came to be. And then, you know, how did you know? Well, like I told you, I just read the documents and the books, and then, okay. So that was the only guy. The rest, they just, I was even sabotaged at the one of the TV stations where I had a friend, which was a photographer, but I told him about 9/11 and what I thought, and then he went like squalling and gossiping around, and that I'd lost my mind, and I thought that was in the CIA that was behind, and blah blah blah. So I lost freelance jobs because just talking to, yeah.
Yeah.
So I learned to shut up then.
Yeah. No, it is interesting. So. You know, I think a big part of that is that people want you to be like them, because if you're making them think or question the official story, that's really uncomfortable.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's like you have to rethink everything, and that's just what one of my friends said too. But if that's right, what you say, Elmer, then we have to rethink everything. Yes, you have to do that.
Yeah.
You have to invert it, you know.
Yeah.
And then, well, I'm not willing to do that, so bye-bye then, you know. So, and then that's it, you know. And I had the same thing with the corona thing. I smelled that far away. And, you know, don't you even touch those jabs, you know. Mm-hmm. Even before they were talking about, they're going to come with their solution, which is the jab, some kind of crap they've been developing for decades, most likely. And I recently found out that, well, I listened to another very good podcaster. I can't listen to much anymore because they're just so behind, you know, they're far behind. I'm sorry. And there are so many shills out there now, so it's like never before.
Well, it's something that I wanted to just interject here. Sent me a recent documentary that you did, And there is a quote, there's a quote in there. You just reminded me of that. It's the Nietzsche quote where he said, the world can be divided into two groups, those who want to believe and those who want to know.
Yes, that's true. I used that in a documentary. Yes, and I'm no fan of Nietzsche. I think that he was one of the first transhuman authors.
Yeah, but it's a good quote nonetheless.
So I used that, and it's like Alan said, he had stopped taking pictures of chemtrails, and you know, after I made that documentary, I was finished with it, you know. Mm-hmm. We tried to get it out to as many as possible, but, you know, and I tried to talk to people, but, you know, just, and the onslaught of the cell phone and social media, people disconnected from nature, you know, and I tried to show them old photo albums. Look, there's no chemtrails. This is summer 1977 mm-hmm. in Norway. Yeah. And here are 100 more pictures, no chemtrails. And then they're like, yeah, but you know, global warming, and you know, people are just come on, you know. So it's like
very hard. I experienced a conversation with somebody a couple of years ago where they had figured out they'd never listened to Alan, they'd never really been into conspiracy theories at all, but they had figured out that this operation that we lived through for the last few years was not what we were being told, you know, so they got that all by themselves. And so I thought, I'm gonna talk to them about chemtrails just because we happen to be out looking at, you know, I said, oh, look at the spraying that they're doing. And he said, mm-hmm. oh, are you one of those that believe in chemtrails? And I thought, well, look, you've just seen everything that they've put us through for the last few years. They'll lie about anything but they're honest about that. You know?
Yeah, that's it. They can see that, but not that.
No, it's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, that is, but just to turn it to the last, that it's the most, I don't know what to call it, but, The Corona, Operation Corona, is the weirdest thing I've ever been through.
Yeah,
I must admit it was so bizarre, and it for me for once the last coffin in the nail. Then we knew already we had a one world government because everybody was going in lockstep, every 185 countries or something.
Yes.
So you know. And I knew that I said to people, think about all the stickers that had to be in all languages. So printing offices had to be alerted beforehand, 6 feet apart in Spanish, Italian, French, German, you see what I mean?
Yes.
So this was a coordinated effort. Just there is a smoking gun. And then you can go on and on and on and all the same talking points in all the different countries. It was just like ludicrous for me.
No, the coordination, and it was obvious the coordination, as you say, down to the little stickers that they had to print in different languages, you know. Yeah. I was illustrating a video the other day, and I found a picture of Anthony Fauci, and the background that he was at a podium talking about something. But the background was some kind of wallpaper that just said safe and effective, all over it, you know, safe and effective, safe and effective.
Yeah.
And, you know, many people wouldn't even notice it because it would kind of blur to their eyes and look like a network emblem or logo or something. But it was coordination that was mind-boggling. And, you know, you're in this disconnect because they're telling us that the World Health Organization needs to have more power, and all of the there needs to be a central body that can be so that there's a more rapid response and a more unified approach to dealing with it. And you're sitting here having observed the last 4 years going, are you kidding me? You couldn't have had a swifter response, more coordinated with, you know, nearly 200 countries on board with it. This was a gang of, they had this so worked out.
Yeah, and then you can always take look at the I went to a one and the 10 years before that, the Rockefeller Group had some exercise, mm-hmm. lockstep, and then I recently, but I can't confirm that, but I recently heard that there was some doctor that was a guest on some program, and he told me that they have been doing, since 1995, they have been tinkering with this vaccine. I can't confirm that, but, but I would think they would be doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
Just testing underground, homeless people, whatever, and seeing, what results and giving different batches to different places. And, so they have some control group and then, I don't know. It seems like it's been harder in America than, for example, Norway, though we have a lot of problems in Norway with the jab. Mm-hmm. But it seems like they wanted to go harder at America.
Yeah, I haven't heard that, far back with it or that kind of information. But what you know is that all of the sudden, an mRNA vaccine is going to be good for everything. It's, it's the cure for cancer. It's, they wanted to tell us that this is, technology they've just been experimenting with, and they rushed it to market to save our lives. Yeah. But at the same time, evidently, the research is so far advanced that now this technology can be used for everything. So it doesn't make sense. It's just little things like that don't add up that you have
because
to.
Because it comes together with other technology we probably don't know they have.
Yes.
So, yeah. And I can just, on this little island I live, it's 68,000 inhabitants on Koh Samui. And I'm about 200 meters from the main road that goes around the island. I'm living in a small Thai village with my Norwegian wife here in our house. But I hear between 8 and 15 ambulances every day just from my vantage point.
Really?
Yeah. Like they're going and coming every day. And it's not an increase in – there are some increase in accidents. And there are a lot in Thailand, but come on, it's people getting heart attacks, strokes, emergencies, suddenly falling over, blood clots, there must be. And I've seen so many just driving with, the lights on, not the sirens, so they're dead already, So, and we have a lot of people down here, we know a lot of expats, that's big problems. They're having dementia, they have no energy. We have Thai friends that have experienced the same thing. And people have died, of course, yes. So, and I'm just trying to follow this, you can go into the gossip news and follow, and see all the sports stars dying left, right, and center every day. Cardiovascular problems and... Yeah, it's bizarre. And then, now when we know so much now it's denial is so powerful and they're doing some kind of damage control, I guess the mainstream media, and they're admitting something, but now it's just mind boggling how they did this. And then I said, I said, how could they get away with it? And they're still getting away with it.
Yes. It's like they deny, and I know what you mean about there is some coverage now about the fact that there is some fallout with it, but it's still not a big deal. It's just like, oh, okay, from time to time we'll talk about a complication or a death or a disease or something, but we're going to downplay it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they're normalizing paddles, to start hearts. Yeah. I mean, they're everywhere. Somebody showed me in one small area in England, there were, three of them. They're like in these open telephone booth kind of things. I mean, this is not normal.
The heart starter is at every corner.
you never heard of this 5 years ago, but now all of a sudden we need to have one every 3 city blocks.
Yeah, and like you just go back to your own childhood, I never ever heard about any kid, you know, dying of a heart attack.
No.
At the football field.
No.
Never happened. Never.
No,
happened.
No.
And no strokes or blood clots. No, nothing.
No.
Nothing. So, you know, and I've heard that from so many people saying the same thing from their childhood, if they're a little bit, you know, up in their 50s and some such. And it's like, it's fantastic how people just like, well, okay, that's normal now. Okay, fine. Now I'm just like, no, this is not normal at all. This is insane. This is unprecedented.
Yeah.
No, never seen anything like this, you know. And of course it must be. You don't need to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out this one.
No.
So, really. So, this is very self-explaining. So, but it's horrible. It's completely horrible. And I said to my wife just, you know, a year and a half ago, just wait when the fallout comes, because this is going to get worse
mm-hmm.
as the years progress.
Mm-hmm.
And we that didn't take the jab and, you know, we are going to have to deal with all those people that are going to be damaged, you know, and dying, and we're going to lose friends, and people are going to be, and, you know, so many, we've made appointments with people, they forget about dinner appointments, and just like, wow, we have to, you know, like call them and say, hey, you forgot about the dinner, oh, yeah, we did then, you know, it's like, it's going to be strainful for us that are left behind, you know, not left behind, but alive.
Well, so, that is a kind of an interesting way of putting it, you know, because they're on another planet. I mean, I was having a long conversation with somebody last week who was talking about personality changes specifically, that they really mm-hmm. noticed a whole variety of things, anger being a big one, impatience, anger, but mm-hmm. certainly forgetfulness, you know. It's
I can confirm that anger, and also I can confirm that, you know, I can see a change in many Thai people. They used to smile all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's an economic downturn, but now the smile is gone. More or less.
Yeah.
They're not smiling like that. Some of the older guy people are, but no, and I see they're a lot more less precise. You know, everything from delivery services, you know, you get the wrong package and or whatever, it doesn't come out at all. Or, you know, it's a lot of those things that I experience, you know, logistics problems with mm-hmm. everything, you know, because people are damaged.
I think in terms of damage and fallout, what is interesting, what is fortunate for some people who did this and then regretted it or had second thoughts or didn't want to go again. I mean, Eric Clapton is one example of a high-profile person who said, this damaged me and I am advising people not to do it. But what you have is that, see, we're not... Our DNA is different. We're all different. And so the way that this will affect people is differently. Some people are dying suddenly, and some people do have, you know, what they're calling turbo cancers, fast-acting cancers.
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot of people, I mean, I put up the redux, the latest redux that I did, and it was kind of funny that you went off in this direction talking. Because some of the things that you said, and I know that you haven't listened to it yet, but some of the things you said were exactly what Alan said in this segment that I put up. Mm-hmm. And one thing that he said about the vaccines is that it will take years to understand the effects. And even if they have been studying this on homeless people, You know, we're talking decades to really understand if something is safe, to understand what's going mm-hmm. to happen. But of mm-hmm. course, they would have planned for this because people can't all die suddenly, right? That wouldn't look
no,
good.
No, that's right. That's right.
And it's that not would a be good obvious. Look.
Yeah. That's what mind boggles me. How they're gonna make this, you know, pan out? Are you gonna force people into cities? Well, they are doing that slowly over time, anyway. But you know, and another thing. I've thought about because of Agenda 21. I read that document and I know what it's about. And I think, you know, this is one great way to get tourism to go away. Mm-hmm. One is to destroy the economy. Two is to make it. Have you noticed that, you know, Boeing has problems with their 737X airplane, which is a commercial airliner, doors falling off in mid-flight and stuff like that.
Oh, I hadn't
and
heard
software
that.
Problems. No, so I think that is just on purpose, just to start to get people to be afraid of flying, number one. And I think down the line, they're probably going to stage some terrible aircraft accidents. And then they have sold, people traveling too much problem mm-hmm. for them, you know. I don't know. That's just a theory I have. I can't prove that, but, you know, we'll see how it pans out. But I, as a son of a pilot, I checked some statistics and I found out that from 2019 until 2004, the international Mayday signals has risen from 1,894%. Let that sink in. That is
what's the year the year span again?
From 2019 until 2024, you have an increase in international Mayday calls from the cockpit, from either the captain or the first officer, that either somebody's sick on the airplane, you know, an SOS Mayday, you know?
So that's huge. Over 1,000%.
Yeah, almost 2,000% increase, but 1,800, I said last time I checked or something.
Wow.
Yeah. So that in itself indicates that they have, and I've seen many stories about pilots just having a heart attack over the Atlantic or something. Yeah. So, and also heard pilots that regret taking the vaccine. Now they lost a job because they're sick, you know?
Yeah.
So there's that one. They can't hide that one, you know? But, you know, then again, I'm a nerd, you know, so anyway, so I just like to find out those things, you know? And also, I noticed on the, I haven't flown much the last years, but I noticed also the flight attendants are, you know, not what they were, you know, they're kind of, you know, I've flown Thai Airways many times and they usually was known to be one of the best airlines in the world. And now they're like below KLM, you know, they're, you know, the air stewardess are going and they're dropping, you know, forks on the ground and, you know, on the floor of the airplane and they're forgetting your order, and it's like, well, this is, you know. So then the American Pilot Association or Aviation, they tried to, you know, oh, no, we have an idea that we just need one pilot in the cockpit for long-haul flights. And then the Pilot Association said, you know, that ain't going to happen in our time. Forget about it, you know. So they had to pull back on that one. But, you know, because they have a shortage of personnel too, you know. Because somebody has been damaged and somebody denied taking the shot and they were fired, you know. And then Delta came back and said, okay, you can come back. This is Delta Airlines. And it's like, what the hell? So the whole thing is like, wow. So it's going to be very exciting, not exciting, but interesting to see the next 5 to 10 years. How all this, you know, comes together, you know, and what happens, you know. But I must say, it's very sad. The whole thing is so sad. But then again, you know, what can you do?
So, well, it is, you know, this is an interesting thing that you, since you have been you know, kind of awake to reality for a long, long time, you've probably experienced this, where you tell someone, this is what's going on, or you say, don't do X, Y, and Z, because if you do X, Y, and Z, this is what's going to happen, because I've been studying it. Well, the first thing they'll do is say that you're a crazy kook. But the second thing, if it becomes obvious that you were right, and Alan said this himself from his own experience, they're going to do one of two things. They're going to conveniently forget that you ever told them what was going to happen or not to do something, or they're going to become really angry with you.
Yeah. And I remember also Alan talking about having a one-on-one way back in time, you know, deprogramming courses with people. And some people came back and they were angry at him because they didn't actually, they were not ready for it.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And yes, and this I have experienced myself too. And it's the old cliche, don't kill the messenger and all that.
Yeah,
but, you know, people just turn on you. Yeah. Yeah. They
Absolutely.
Do. Yeah. And that's what I'm, you know, I'm just like, I'm just watching now. I feel I'm watching a slow motion global air crash, you know, with the vaccines and everything. And, you know, and, but nobody's talking really about it, you know, like it's not a subject nobody talks about over dinner table, you know, it's like, they're just like, oh, he died of cancer suddenly, or he had a stroke, and that's, you know, a little bit strange, but, you know, pass over the dressing, you know, and then it's like, I'm also, one other thing I've discovered, I don't know, I can't prove this scientifically, but I feel that people, some people have become, well, for a lack of a better word, evil, more evil, you know, selfish evil. We talked about that just, you know, after they took taking the shot, they're like becoming even more antisocial than possible with the cell phone. And it's like, wow, you know, and they are just like so fatigued, and they're let's go to the beach, let's do that. No, I have no energy, and I'll just stay home and watch some TV, and okay, fine, you know. So I notice, you know, that the cognitive abilities of people is diminishing slowly, you know. And that, of course, is people are different genes, and people have taken different batches, and of course, and there's all this that, and what they eat and how they live, and, you know, but, you know, the people that haven't taken it are just fine. You know, so it's like, it's no doubt what's going on, but it's so sad. It's like the biggest elephant in the room ever, you know. And in Norway now they're trying to change the law with you know, so they can force vaccinate people.
Really?
In the future. Yeah. They have, I don't know how the voting went in the parliament. I haven't heard yet, but maybe there is some pushback, but that's scary, you know. But then again, you know, I said to my wife, the date that comes, I don't care if it's 2035 and somebody's going to force me to take something, I don't know what is, for something that I don't know what is either, I'm going to fight for my life. They're not going to infringe on my skin or my body or my health. Yeah, you see what I mean?
No way.
I'd rather be dead, you know?
Well, I totally understand that, because if we're not free, what is the point? And I do know that you can be free in your own mind, but when you're talking about something that has a potential to harm your mind, you've lost.
Yeah, and that brings me up to, you know, I have been reading some old Rudolf Steiner books from, oh, they're over 100 years old now, and other books, and I've listened to some podcasts with some elderly men, very well read, and they have said that actually, well, I cannot, you know, this is just through Rudolf Steiner and a few other German, you know, scientists at the time, early 1900s or 1910, 20, and they were warning about the vaccine industry and that they wanted to try to make some kind of potion or something that could attack your soul in a way, or
yes,
your,
you know,
mind.
This is,
you know,
very interesting, yeah, because I yeah, will admit right off the bat that I've listened to about half an hour of Rudolf Steiner and I've never read anything that he has written. And I'd like to, it's come up in topics and I've had someone who's benefited from listening and studying. And that was one thing that she pointed out is he warned about this over 100 years ago. And exactly what you just said, that it's going to go to that part of you, or that's what they aim to hit, is that part of you that is your soul, that is the essence, yeah, that can communicate with something beyond or something higher. And then I've had, you know, people get back on, you know, conversations that I've, and I'll just admit, ignorantly had, because I'm not really familiar with him other than that I have a niece who is a Waldorf teacher and has been a Waldorf teacher for a number of years and loves the Waldorf schools, and those are Steiner started. But,
yeah.
You know, it's clear that he was on to something when he said, this is a way in to harm you in this way. Because think about, you know, the one that Alan was quoting all the time was Bertrand Russell, that we're going to do it with injunctions, with injections, with diet.
Excellent, yeah. Diets, yeah, that's right. I remember that. Yeah.
And
true,
you know,
true. And that, yeah, it corresponds perfectly. And of course, you know, and we know that they operate, you know, you can see that, you know, just, you know, they have all their toys all ready to go on the ground, but, you know, they can't push it too fast or else people will just look up and then, come on, where did this come from, you know? So the military are so advanced. They're, you know, 30, 40, 50, 100 years, you know, ahead of anybody's imagination, you know?
Yes.
With technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, and of course that trickles down into the commercial market, you know, and then it's slowly given out, you know, and then people just slowly boil in the frog pan, you know? And they don't think much about it, and then I you know, it's, that's why I also made that latest documentary is about, you know, how NASA is fooling everybody with Hollywood and, you know, the whole space opera thing.
I just want to mention that quickly. I'll be posting that one with this talk, and I may even use some of your footage in there, but it's called NASA. NASA plus Nazis and Hollywood. And it's really good. You did a good job. I enjoyed it.
That was one of the biggest awakening I had in my life when I discovered that they're lying about everything about space. Almost everything.
Mm-hmm.
We can't check it ourselves. And I'm a photographer and I've been doing photography since I was 13 years old. And then I went professional. And I can see when something is computer generated or is on film or is like, what the hell is going on here? And I can see when things are lit up from 6 angles or 5 angles. And I said, there's no way, like the moon landings, I'm just like a 5-year-old with an IQ of 95 can figure out that's fake, you know? you know? but of course, you know, it's like a religion for people.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
It's become like a sideshow, you know? So, and everybody's like, and I use this metaphor. Okay, let's say we could go to Mars and all these places and they're not faking anything of the footage. Why would we go to a dry, dead planet when we have one that's perfectly fine here?
Mm-hmm.
What is all this hype about going to places that are lifeless? You see what I mean? That makes no sense. You know? So and so on. And Elon Musk is out there, and he's of course an actor on the world stage, and it's so it's and people are get and people get mad. But even today, and I say, if it was so easy for in 1969 until 72, 73. Six times perfectly, NASA, with their Apollo missions, then must, of course, name everything from Greek gods, of course. And they perfectly landed and came back. But nobody in 52 years have ever sent a manned mission again.
Yeah.
What's going on? You know, it just it falls apart. And then the footage, and okay, so you build a spacecraft, you say it costs $150 billion, you put the worst thinkable camera on it. That doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense, you know. You see, and it's always grainy, fussy, and oh, we lost connection. And they're kicking down the can down the road all the time. Artemis, oh, we're going to the moon. We sent this with some dummies inside the cockpit. And it's just like, why? You did this perfectly half a century ago. What's the problem? You know.
Well, I love what the astronaut in the film, the astronaut that is interviewed that said, "Well, we used to have this technology, but unfortunately, we lost it, and so now we're trying to get it." Yeah. What?
Yeah. The dog, the NASA dog, they ate their homework, you know. So and they lost the tapes. They had the budget problem in the sentence. Come on, give us a break.
Yeah. Now we used to. I mean, that was just pretty priceless. Yeah, we did have the ability to get past the Van Allen belt, but we lost that. Misplaced that.
But I think actually the Van Allen belt is just a cover for. I would go as far as call it the firmament or some high pressure barrier that they can't. Well, they say now, NASA, and you can see in the documentary too, that they admit they never have been higher than low Earth orbit, and that's about 70-80 miles, 100 miles.
It's pretty funny. I mean, it's actually shocking, but it's also quite humorous.
Yeah, it's funny and shocking, and I was just liberated because. Then I in that process with just researching all that space material and all that science fiction programming and all that, and I think, this is perfect because it fits perfectly into the Darwinian model because, you're just an ant, you're a speck on a piece of dirt flying around just by coincidence, and you came from some salamander that didn't have reproduction organs for 2 million years, and then suddenly you have a brain and you're a sentient being, you know, millions. All, you know, we know that all this is bullcrap, but even Darwin admits it himself. And I think it was his grandfather that wrote the original book, Original the Species, according to Alan. And it fits perfectly in with the space thing because then people, we're just like, you know, we're just going around the sun, 100,000 miles, kilometers an hour, and you know this, and they're scaring people with comets that never hits, or asteroids that never hits, all through my life. Oh, this comet, it's very never hits.
Yeah.
And nothing hits the moon either. That's another thing. It's the same craters as in 1980. 1975. It's the same. I've been filming the moon a lot through telescopes and everything. It's just the same thing.
Did you ever see a television show that Alan mentioned a few times? A British show from 1968, I think, called The Newsbenders.
Oh yes. I saw that one. That is perfect.
It's perfect. That is perfect.
I've shown that to a lot.
I showed
that to a lot of folks. Yeah.
Well, see, to me, I think that what your documentary does is give this piece of half-hour British television fiction, you have legitimized the con. You have shown how the con is pulled off. Because in that half hour, basically what we learn is, oh, there's a secret brotherhood or whatever. But, you know, those in the know control the news. And they don't just control the news. They don't say you can publish this, but you can't publish that. They actually create the news. And you can see in the studio, they are faking a moon landing. I mean, come on, this is 1968.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And then, you know, even the James Bond movie, it's not Goldfinger, it's one with Sean Connery. I think that was in the 70s. That was 71, 72, and there was still, that was the last moon landing, and they kind of poked the viewer by him raiding a studio and taking a moon boogie, you know, out, and he saw, you know, astronauts in a TV setting, you know, with lights and... It's like, you know, and then you can see Capricorn 1 from 1977.
And
that's, you know, that's interesting too. So, you know, but that's, you know, it's always, you can't use that as proof or anything, but the proof is in the pudding when you look at the mathematics doesn't add up, the pictures doesn't add up. There should be a time lag. You can't have a telephone landline and no time lag to the moon if the distance they say it is 300,000 miles and so forth. It's just like everything falls apart. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything. When you look at it, you know, with little bits of scrutiny. So and tin foil, like, come on, give us a break, man. You know, so it's, but people want to believe, and it's like, you know, belief. And I think for Americans, it's supposed to be like, they felt very proud, you know?
Well, it's part of American exceptionalism. Yeah. Look what we did.
Yeah, we are so fantastic. The greatest country in the world. And look, we landed on the moon. And now we can't go, we don't know how to go back.
Yeah.
But at the time, I think there was done a survey, and a lot of Americans actually didn't buy it at the time. They said they were fakery. Yeah.
Yes. Well, my grandfather was one of those. You know, I remember, and when I was young, you know, the family all thought he was a kook because, of course, we went to the moon. You know what I mean? So, so granddad just like, no, we didn't do it. Didn't happen.
No. And then, you know, I do in a documentary, I just ask the simple question, if there is in nothing, there is, nature hates a vacuum. Okay?
Yes. Yeah.
So it abhors a vacuum. So in a vacuum, how can you have anything burning? Because you need oxygen, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how can a rocket work in a zero, in nothingness, in vacuum, and then have nothing to push, to accelerate on? Mm-hmm. Then you have to bring oxygen and rocket fuel. Then, and I think Werner Braun actually spilled some of the beans. He said that you needed three Empire State Buildings just in fuel to just leave Earth orbit.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the things like that, but, you know, those things are just forgotten in time. But, and he has some interesting things on his tombstone. It's not the proof, but it's, I think, verse 19, 19, 1, 19, 3, when it says, and God's handiwork is shown through his creation of the firmament or something like that. That's on the tombstone of Wernher von Braun. That was the Apollo leader of the Saturn rocket and chief engineer. And that, why would he have that on his tombstone?
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. So, no, I think, you know, and how the Earth is shaped and all these flat Earth things. I'm not a flat Earther, but I'm just like, you know, they're lying about so many things, and I think they're lying about the size of where we live. Mm-hmm. I think so. And also, what's interesting is we have all these, they have the Antarctic Treaty. 58 countries have signed that in 1958, and you have the international space agencies working together. China, India, Russia, America, Britain. When you have all these treaties, how can they be enemies?
Yes, right? Yes. Yeah.
That's another telltale. That's a big red flag, you know?
Yeah.
That just tells that they're long, long time ago, they agreed upon this, you know?
Yeah.
And the theater of war is just for the normal people out there to just, like, gobble up, you know?
You do kind of reach a point where you understand. I mean, Alan talked about the sharing of information between scientists from Russia.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, Soviet Union and the U.S. and the West and whatnot. But so on a certain level, wars can be fought and they're real and there can be loss of life and strategy and people who really, really take it seriously. But at the upper level where we can't see who's got the strings on the marionettes, they've got a whole different thing going on. It's a whole, you know, it's like a play within a play, if you will. It's not at all what we think it is. And I've gone through different points in my journey of understanding where I've gone through different places where I just think everything is rubbish. You know, oh, that's just, it's just manufactured.
Yeah, now everybody's screaming about this guy that put himself on fire in the Middle East. And I said, and you see, it's just like so timely. It's time, and then all the truth channels that jump on that and they talk for that with about that for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably just a stuntman.
Yes.
You know? Yeah, and it's like, oh, come on, stop wasting your time. They're just like dishing it out, you know? It's a... go grow some tomatoes instead. You know? You know, it's like, and it's fascinating to see that, and Alan was talking about this 15, 16 years ago, that just watch out. They're going to tighten the noose of the internet. First, it's going to be open and free, and people can say whatever they want on YouTube, and then it's going to be tighter and tighter, you know? And look now.
Yes.
The quality of the so-called truth movement is such terrible conditions compared to what it was. And now we can't find information that's valuable, you know?
Well, so harder. You're absolutely on a wavelength with the Redux that I just put up, because Alan made that exact same comment about truth or, you know, slash alternative or whatever that you just made, you know, during, he said this in 2020, he said it's, you used to have genuine voices that were coming out and saying things that mattered and needed to be heard. And we don't have that, with rare exceptions. We really don't have that now.
No, it's gone down, like I say, 85% or something like that. Yeah. And I have, I've been watching so many different, you know, channels through the years, and, you know, and I can just, like, I have a young Canadian musician friend, he's 41, young is, well, younger than me, but he's very informed, and he's, you know, truth seeker, and he's unvaxxed, and he gets everything, you know, and I, not everything, and I tried to steer him in the right direction, and now he's, Don't listen to Alex Jones, I say. You know, it's a waste of time. He's just a fear monger. He's going to sell all the other products. And then, no, thank you for the advice. And I try to, you know, point to cutting through the matrix. But what I've experienced a lot is that it's too much for people. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's, it's too heavy. And I know always Alan said that, people complain I'm negative, but he was not negative. He's just saying the facts, you know?
Yeah.
He's just reading up from documents, and this is what they say. And, you know, well, if you can't take it, that's not my problem, you know?
Well, one of the techniques in the alternative world, because... Yeah. You know, don't forget there's advertisers to be satisfied. They have networks, and whatever their mission statement is about doing something to change things, they have bills to pay and people that are working for them, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So
of course.
They're limited right off the bat. They are constrained, but you have a rhythm there that is expected. And that Alan didn't have to, he didn't have to follow that rhythm. So he could talk for 5 or 6 hours if he wanted to. Yeah. People used to write sometimes and say, why don't you have a rant? It would be so good if you just let yourself go and rant. Well, you know, that really wasn't his style, because that's kind of like wrestling or it's entertainment, it's show business.
You've got expected
rhythms, you know. You talk about, you whip up the fear for X amount of minutes, and then you deliver a solution, and different shows have different solutions. So the solution might be donating to the building of a church, or the solution might be buying gold and silver, or the solution might be taking a supplement. You see what I mean? There's something to be sold. But
they're selling wine, they're selling this, that, whatever. And there's been, you know, come on, it's like I can smell a COINTELPRO or a Shell from a mile away.
Yeah.
And I have I have my own folder here just to show, you know, my newfound, you know, like Bob, the musician, that's the truth. And I just show him, like, here's 44 shills. Just look at them. Don't listen to these guys, okay? It's like, how do you know that? Well, experience. I've been listening to tens of thousands of hours for 20 years. So, you know, it's like it becomes your life in a way. Because, you know, now you're seen outside, inside, then you can't go back. You can't close Pandora's box, you know, so. And then on the way, you just, here's Jay Dyer. He's connected to InfoWars. He's a shill. Here you have, We Are Changed. You're paid by the same guys. And, you know, so.
I do my very best, Elmer. Not to name names, you know, part of it is this, as Alan would say, you can't think for people.
No, that's true.
So they've got to, you know, and then if you are, you know, kicking their favorite hero in the kneecaps, they're like, and everybody comes to the information in their own way. And I also have to say this. There are a lot of people who discovered Alan Watts Talks because they found him on Alex Jones, for instance, or whatever, you know.
Yeah, I understand how it works. Of course, he was there, but he was there just a few times, you know.
Yeah.
And you can see the deterioration of the guests he has had home since early 2000s. You know, it's just gone downhill. And he was like a system critic. Now he's just, and suddenly in 2016, he's embracing the fake two-party system, you know?
And then I will say this, if anybody is telling you to vote for somebody, they really are either a shill or they're totally clueless. This is not.
And how can you go back?
You cannot say that you are awake to reality, but there is a solution to be found in the voting booth. That this is, it doesn't add up in a way that stinks to high heaven. Whoever it is who's saying it.
Yeah. So that's why I say too, and I hate to use the cliche that Mark Twain said, allegedly many have said this, that if voting actually could change anything, it would be illegal.
That's right.
And that's yeah. So it's kind of that way. And you know, I think there, but I have hope for the future too, because I see in America that a lot of people are doing homesteading, and they're coming together, they're helping each other, they're building slowly new communities. And so I see some silver linings on the clouds, actually.
I noticed that too. I noticed that in the last 4 years, and I think that's a good thing. And I try to, you know, some of these people who are doing homesteading and who are having gardens, they are also going to Trump rallies, and they're also voting. And it's like, well, you can't you can't dismiss them out of hand and say, oh, well, you don't get it at all, because waking up is a process. And if they're doing one positive thing, like helping their neighbor, and then two positive things, like growing a garden and helping their neighbor, there's hope there.
Good. Yeah, that's very good. And that's good enough.
Yeah.
For starters.
Yes, absolutely.
So. So that's how I look at it.
The second part is going to go up at the end of the month. And I thank you all for listening. I've really enjoyed this because I had not spoken to Elmer before. He had been communicating with Alan for years, and it was fun to just dive right into a conversation with you. And then, but I also want to say for the listeners that next week I will be talking with Neil Foster, and Neil is just getting back from the UK. He's still over there right now as I record, but as far as I know, he'll be back next week and we'll be talking. So I thank you all for listening, and tune in at the end of the month for part two with Elmer. Well, I've got something.